Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Do you have strong passwords for your online accounts? To be honest, most people don't. Today we're going to take a look at a way to say goodbye to weak passwords with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, back with us. He's a technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. He focuses on desktop and laptop security projects. Jesse has looked into some password managers, has lots of info for us, and he'll also answer your other computer-related questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And Jesse, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Before we start with passwords, there's been a lot of stories in the news about the Intel security problem. Can you give us a brief overview of that?
Yeah, probably very brief. There's a lot of information about it. So if there's anyone out there who enjoys computer science, there's a lot of great articles about this vulnerability. Specifically, this vulnerability relates to any of our x86 or Intel primarily processors that are running on laptops, desktops, cell phones, a lot of different devices all around the world. And this infrastructure or this architecture flaw has actually... which is kind of a feature that was built in, but this flaw has been there for about 20 years. And a lot of different researchers from around the world stumbled into this vulnerability over the last few months, and it affects most systems that we have. Everyone's, you know, day-to-day computer they might be utilizing, whether it's running Linux, Windows, or Mac OS. It's built into this chip. So it's the processor that's in everyone's computer that is the originator of the flaw, and it's deep-seated with how the operating system utilizes the chip and can offer some data sharing that is a little scary. I think the one thing people, you know, notice on their computers is one program might be able to access data that it shouldn't be able to. So, for example, your chat program, your Word application, contained on one system, it's still a very frightening thing for a lot of these computer secrets to come out in applications that should really have no business seeing them, which is, you know, a vector people might be able to get information they shouldn't be able to see. But it's even more troubling on infrastructure that we have throughout the world, whether it's, you know, primarily data centers or other systems where we have scaling or scaled compute resources, such as what we consider the cloud. So everything out there that has all this physical architecture that's hosting virtual appliances or virtual servers that are hosting websites and other content, this flaw could potentially allow one user using one virtual machine to access data from a different virtual machine that they don't own. Yeah. So it allows for potentially a lot of data snooping. And right now there are a variety of patches out. There's a lot of patches under development. But it's something that people are concerned about, obviously, because there's a lot of data out there that people will... that this could allow, you know, systems to access. And there are a couple... kind of proof of concept vulnerabilities that people had basically created to see if the vulnerability existed or what they could do with it. And, you know, right now, whether there's things in the wild, at least I wasn't able to see of anything that, you know, people are actively exploiting it, but it's actually something that could have been exploited for the last 20 years. So whether it's something that actually is being exploited right now, I think, at least from what I've seen, is unknown. But it's possible that we could have had exploits out there for at least 10, you know, if not close to 20 years. And patches are being released, but I think there's also calls in the question of what is it really... You know, what's really required to remediate it? And one of the things that's kind of coming up is, well, you may need to replace all your processors. And over time, that's going to naturally happen. But how this, you know, there's only certain things you can do with hardware and having physical access to a device. I mean, granted, still, somebody has to have physical access, but it opens up other alternatives to get data that might not have already existed, or social engineering attacks. but we'll kind of see more as things go forward. It actually hasn't been that long since this has kind of come out, and I think over the next few weeks or months, we're going to hear a lot more about it. But right now, patches are out for some systems. How effective those patches are, I think, is still uncertain, especially when any big vulnerability comes out. A lot of users do want to see patches on their system, so patches are released, but you never know when you create a patch very quickly. Yeah. Does that patch potentially create another vulnerability? Does it really resolve what's there? And that's always something that happens day by day with computers and kind of what we do. But we'll see a lot more in the coming weeks.
Something to keep our eyes on, and you'll be keeping us up to date on this, I imagine, as things develop.
Yeah, in a couple months, I think we're going to see a lot more information about it and what the impact is or was. But it could still be something we feel for years. I think there's just a lot unknown, especially because it's hard to know what else is happening throughout the entire world on every computer everywhere. But it'll be interesting to see how this develops.
Part of digital security, of course, is the password. And you have looked into password managers a bit now. Maybe explain what a password manager does.
Yeah, so the whole reason it comes about is, we used to have maybe one username and password. Probably at some point, we probably had no usernames or password. Our computer opened up and we just used it. However, with security, the idea was I want to be the only one who can access my data. And so I have a username and password that allows me to access my information. No one else can access it without having that username and password. But as time has moved on over the last couple decades, we have more and more things that require a different username and password. They're not synchronized in any way. They're completely unique. And it's difficult to remember all that stuff. So password managers really exist to manage that information that for ourselves is really difficult, especially if we do want to maintain secure passwords. I don't want to make my password, for example.
Right.
I want it to be complicated. I want it to be random, if possible. And for me to remember that for one password, not to mention 10, 20, or 30, becomes really, really challenging. So a password manager is really something to help contain all of those credentials. In this case, a credential, proving who I am. But containing those in a way where I can access it and access all of my passwords using a common authentication method that protects all of my passwords but allows me to unlock that box so I can access all the keys for my different programs or services.
One of the things that worries me about this is, if somebody is able to break into the manager, then they've got everything.
Yep, and that's a very, very common problem. And the way I'm kind of thinking about it now is if you have, you have all these keys for all these services, right? These are your passwords, and these are contained in a box that's locked. Well, what if you break the box open and you get access to all these keys? Well, we need to make sure you have really good protection on that box, and that's where multi-factor authentication comes in. If I have a username and password, that is a good amount of protection, but it also depends on how complicated that password is. What my username is, how easy are certain portions to guess. But adding another factor dramatically improves the security of getting through that, whether that might be biometrics. So proving who I am by what I am, so by fingerprint, by retinal scan, any of that information, or by proving I have something specific, which Google Authenticator on a device such as a cell phone can prove, I have this code because I have this phone. So putting those different factors in place helps to secure that more and more, but it does offer the potential risk of, what if I lose one of those factors?
Yeah.
What if I lose my cell phone? Some of the programs have fail-safe so you can get in, but once again, that's kind of a balance of that security vulnerability and checks and balances, and I don't think there's a perfect way to do it. But it's kind of the same idea of, proving who you are when you go to the DMV. How do you prove who you are to a certain degree without making the process really cumbersome or open to identity theft? And I think every different manufacturer tries to find a different way, but that multi-factor authentication, let's try to make it easy as well as add security, which, you know, the iPhone X, for example, came out and they're all about the face authentication right now. If that works to add the complexity necessary, doesn't allow for a lot of false positives where, you know, somebody else could potentially authenticate as you even though they're not you. If it does what it needs to do and, you know, makes it that much harder, but it's easy, I think that's really where a lot of different companies want to go. They want to make it secure, but want to make it easy because otherwise you're just not going to do it. We'll have post-it notes all over the place.
Mike in Algoma has a question that relates to this, so let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm not the sharpest tack in the box. I'll readily admit that. So maybe I'm missing something totally, but passwords. So we're talking about all this secure, you know, making a complex password. Wouldn't the same thing apply to a user word, a username, I mean? Instead of just saying that my username is Mike, which could easily be hacked, shouldn't I make that also very complex so that it, essentially it doubles the job that the hacker needs to go through to get to my computer?
And I think that's a really good question, and it brings up some other ideas of, you know, security through obscurity. If no one knows what it is, they're not going to know what they're breaking into or whose account they might be breaking into. And I think that's something that could be done to add another layer of complexity. But I think that also, you know, is that balance between can you remember what it is? Can you remember what it's used for? And I kind of go back and forth on this. Most people utilize usernames that are in some ways pretty easily guessable, whether it's an email address or your first and or last name. Those are very, very common. I think having a random username does help as well. But is it going to help as much as having a really good password? I think you're only going to get a certain amount of gain by also choosing a random username. But each situation is a little different.
Yeah.
Okay. Goodbye.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mike. We'll go to Brad in Whitewater next. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
On the subject of secure passwords, I've come up with a system of character substitutions that are really easy to remember for an individual, but very hard to hack. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
Okay. Choose a word, preferably a long word, and then start substituting some of the letters out. For example, instead of the letter T, use the plus sign. Instead of the letter A, use the up arrow. Instead of the letter G, use the ampersand. Instead of the letter I, use the exclamation point. This is a fairly simple substitution that really is not very intuitive for somebody who's trying to hack in, and it does meet some of the requirements of so many of the websites these days that want you to use an uppercase letter, a lowercase letter, a digit, and some kind of a character.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it's definitely a good item to do that helps to make passwords remember or memorable for you and not necessarily for other people. And one item that a lot of individuals try to do is try to translate into what they call leet speak. So lowercase a becomes an at symbol. And you can replace different characters, but I think, you know, your example that you brought up, translating and replacing for things that may not be as normal. For example, I think a plus and a T, I could probably use that as a replacement pretty easily in my own mind, but using an up arrow, for example, instead of an at symbol is a little bit different for me. And it's basically the idea of you're actually kind of encrypting your password in a way. You still have your password, but you're using what they call a substitution cipher to actually replace one character with another. Probably a common thing that at least I think I did it, and I think a lot of other kids did it. You kind of create your own languages. So you and your friend know what you're talking about, but no one else has any idea because you made this hidden language. And it's very similar, and I think it helps to make you remember. And there's still that, there's always, and I think that helps dramatically, especially for remembering. You always have the additional challenge too of, well, if anyone knows you well enough,
yeah,
how secure is it to somebody who knows you? And I think it's a possibility, but I think it helps dramatically if you're able to use different substitutions to make your passwords much more complicated and more difficult for anyone else to understand. And I liked your substitutions a lot because they're actually more uncommon than I think I've seen.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Brad, thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Visiting today with Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And if you have an issue relating to security, I hope you'll join in. Or if you just have a computer problem that you're trying to deal with, you can join us for that as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. At 11 tomorrow, we'll talk about talk with a life coach about why women don't chase their dreams as often as they probably should be. That's tomorrow at 11. Right now, we're taking a look at your computer today with Jesse LeGrew. Give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Sue emailed to say she tried to download a password app but couldn't figure out how to run it. Any advice for which password managers you like based on price and ease of use?
And for me, there's a lot of different solutions out there, and some of them are actually free. So I think it really depends on kind of the need. I've used KeePass in the past for local password managers. I can use it on macOS, I can use it on Linux, I can use it on Windows, and it's completely free. It has limitations, that multiple-factor authentication that I was kind of talking about earlier, of being able to have, you know, a master password to unlock this box and get access to the keys. Having that second factor of using a Google Authenticator or any kind of biometric, any of those additional factors are useful. I've also used LastPass in the past, which has been extremely useful, and they have a lot of enterprise features as well, not just for personal users. And there are really a ton of different options out there. I personally like LastPass. I've used other password managers like KeePass in the past. The biggest challenge is always finding that the lock or the key to have it a little bit as complicated as possible to open up your password manager. That's really the biggest barrier. If you have a weak password, but it can access 100 different passwords that you have, it doesn't really help you very much.
No.
So really making that as secure as possible is usually my goal, and I'd want to have at least two factors of authentication to get access to it, whether that being something I have like Google Authenticator having on my cell phone that's always with me, or having biometric or some other kind of tool. But for me, if I'm wandering around, some password managers may not be as useful as others. So, for example, KeePass is something I use on a desktop or a laptop. But if I have my cell phone with me, can I use it or not?
Yeah.
And that's always the other question. When do I need to access my passwords? And there are a variety of other applications out there. And I haven't used a lot of them for mobile devices. MSecure is one that I was able to find right away on iOS. But there are a lot of different password managers that have apps for Android, for iOS. They work on macOS. They work on Windows. It kind of depends on what your cross-compatibility needs are and often how frequently you need to access those passwords. Because part of me would say, well, the best password manager is have it printed out, having to go to a safe deposit box at a bank, have it there where you need two key, you know,
yeah.
Do it that way. And granted, your passwords are still unencrypted, but there's so many barriers to get in to grab it,
Yeah. Which
makes it more complicated. When you have a service like LastPass, it actually, you give them the piece of paper, they scramble it up. They can't read it. Only you can read it, and you still have to go through all those barriers to get access to that piece of paper. Do you want a physical, do you want a virtual, or do you want a both? Because what if your service fails? What if LastPass goes under? What if they stop developing a program? You know, there's all those other things of what are you willing to accept if you can't get to your passwords, which I think is a good thing for everyone to ask, because that's a possibility. Whenever you put all your information into a password manager, you offer the possibility of not being able to get into it and losing that. And that's where password resets and a lot of other things come into play, where most services allow you to reset your password pretty easily, which in some ways can kind of defeat the purpose.
Yeah.
So it's challenging, and that's why I like password managers. Multiple factors of authentication are always useful, and verification on password resets I think is also useful, where somebody physically calls you from a number that you've already had verified. There's a lot of other pieces in play, but I know there's a lot of different applications out there, and if, in this case for the user, if they weren't able to find the program that they downloaded, it could be listed somewhere else in the computer. There could be a different application you could download. A lot of pieces I don't know of, you know, why it wasn't able to be run. But I know there are a lot of great options out there, and if one seems a little clunky, you can always try another.
Harold in Superior has a password manager, I believe. Hi, Harold. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Just a few comments here. I've used Dashlane for quite a few years now, and I've used LastPass as well, and I don't know, going back and forth, it seems like they toggle, this one has jumped a ladder, and this one's climbed the next. You know, they're going back and forth, each getting better. I think they're kind of really a pain to use. They're a pain to learn. I wouldn't be without it. And so grin and bear it. I've got about 250 passwords. And one thing that I don't think you mentioned was better password managers will suggest a password for you. So I just hit that key and say generate password, and away you go. And I don't try to remember them.
Yeah. Yeah.
From a security standpoint, really important. And then they have the security checker within Dashlane, at least, and it checks to make sure you don't have duplicates and unsafe passwords and those that are old and should be changed. And it'll even auto-change a number of them. It doesn't seem to work perfect, but gosh sakes, it's next to antivirus, it's right in there. And they do have free trials. In fact, some of them you can use if you only have like 15 passwords, you can use it for free. And as is the case with my wife, and for all the computers I manage, two PCs, a couple Chromebooks, a tablet, two cell phones, every one of them has a password manager, and it's all the same password manager. I think people should also think about printing out or exporting periodically exporting to hard copy, and then you can print it out, and you know you have another place where it is. And
mm-hmm.
So that's, I guess, about it.
Well, I appreciate your call, Harold. Comments from you, Jesse?
Yeah, and I think it was another great example of, you know, having multiple devices that are a little bit different, but having a password manager solution that worked on all of them. I think that's really important depending on needs, but also the fact that many of these will also give suggestions, look at your other passwords, are there ones that match, but a lot of them will offer to just simply randomly generate passwords for you, which helps to increase that security. You don't necessarily need to see it either. But also exporting is another important thing. In the event you are offline, don't have the internet, need to access your passwords, having an offline copy that you protect either physically or digitally is really important in case there is some issue. Because if your passwords are all hosted in some data center that you don't have access to, and that data center goes away or there's some network issue, you can't access it for days, having that offline copy in some way can be really useful. And that's where, like, a safe deposit box, something else off-site is really useful as well.
Harold, again, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Kim a chance to join in Sauk City. Kim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I got my first tablet perhaps a year ago, and my neighbors are very close. They said, you know, you can use our Wi-Fi. And so I purchased an Orbi, which gives you two stations, and one was set up at their house and then the other in my house. And the wife works from home for a company, a national company, and she was concerned recently that me being connected to that Wi-Fi that there would be problems of hacking or, you know, it affecting her business. Can you give me any information on that, if that's a probability or...
With any kind of wireless, I think that's always a possibility, especially the more available the wireless network is, the more likely somebody might be looking to break into it or to do something, you know, nefarious, something that you just wouldn't want. Where I normally look at, where are the security features for that wireless network that help to protect it from attack? And in this case, you know, whether it's malicious users that are external. So in this case, people just driving by the neighborhood trying to access the wireless network, or if there's some other concern with just other people, you know, in your household that might be using it that they're concerned with. I think they're different challenges. But first, I would look at some of the technical components with how the network is set up, assuming it's really just looking at, I'm concerned with people externally that I don't know accessing it. Okay. And how to protect that. And I think there's a lot of different best practices you can use, you know, Orbi or a lot of other wireless extender or wireless systems like that. They all have that same challenge. And whether it's something that you can access only in one room or you can access for an entire city, the same challenges occur. It's just how big is that net and how many people can try to attack it.
Okay.
All right.
That was our concern. Thank you. I appreciate that. Mm.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Jeff in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there, Larry. You actually had a great idea for how to manage passwords and have a unique password for every site that's asked for, and they're non-repeating, and it was on your show about 15 years ago, and I haven't heard it since, but I use it all the time. Somebody called it, or I don't remember if it was your guest or somebody called in and said, if the whatever site is asking for the password, just look up at the URL of the page that's right there in front of you. I just pointed at my page. I can't believe I did that. And pick the last seven digits and use that as your password. So right now I've got a page up, and if it was asking for the password here, I'd type in 155A, lowercase a, uppercase U, ampersand, and that's it. So every time you come to that page, when they ask for my password, it's right in front of me.
I'd forgotten
that. And
that
was on your show, Larry.
Man, that's a long time back, Jeff. I don't remember it. Is that safe? Jesse?
I think that always depends on the URL, because at least for me, it raised the question, is the URL user-specific, or is it something, if I knew the URL, then I could guess basically any single password. So as long as I knew who the user was, I can go to any website and it's like, well, I always know it's going to be the last seven.
Or you skip three letters and you know, start three in, because you can always do it. And that way I've never had to remember a password since.
Oh. Well, yeah, there'd be a different way, or you could put them in backwards.
Yep.
Yeah, there'd be another way to do it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of ways to obscure it. You know, where you pick the password, how many characters is it, every three. And that's kind of where the, like, internal ciphering comes from, which is, you know, technology that existed before we started using computers. It's just a different methodology and using a different data set to create that cipher.
Technically, you are correct. I don't use the last seven because of what you've said, but I haven't told you my I happen to have a number that I use on everyone that I go in that many numbers, and I won't tell you what my number is.
Yep. And that's the biggest thing, is as long as you keep your secret, then, you know, that's a part of it where, yep, you know, whether you have a password manager and you have that, basically in this case, that's the master password for the password manager, is that and methodology used to take a URL and generate a password from it.
Exactly. And it's also because I have friends that use variations on their a same password that they use all the time. Well, if you get one of their passwords, you can figure out what all of theirs are, whereas mine, everyone is unique.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeff, thank you.
I'm just reminding you, Larry. So now in 15 years, we'll remind you again.
All right. Well, 15 years from now, let's see, what year would that be? 2033, that would be somewhere around there. Jill, make a note of that. Jeff will be calling back. Oh, man. Thanks, Jeff. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. We've been visiting about security issues, but we'll take other kinds of questions as well. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Steve emailed to ask if you could comment on the use of money transfer systems like Venmo, PayPal, and also the service for customers of banks or credit unions. Are these services bug-free? Are they user-friendly? I'm using a service used by credit unions. It's called P2P, but it seems tricky, like it won't let you know what's an invalid character, for example.
Hmm. And I guess for the different money transfer systems, it always depends on the system. I think, is anything bug-free? I'm hesitant to say yes, because there's usually something we may not even be aware of that's kind of behind the surface, including this Intel vulnerability, with it, which if you're running on Intel hardware or other manufacturers, AMD, it's not just Intel that's having this this challenge. If it's running on it, it could be a potential issue. But I've used a lot of different transfer services. I mean, PayPal was something that came out quite some time ago, and everyone kind of jumped on. Each of them has a little bit different usability, but in many cases, there's not really great user-friendly alternatives. And actually, PayPal is pretty easy to use for me. I also utilize an internal credit union transfer app that they have, which seems to work pretty well. It also depends on what your credit union is, because each credit union, institution, financial institution will have different services available. So I'd utilize the services you have available right now for free, and you can always bridge out. But I've personally liked them, and I wasn't quite sure about the invalid character piece of it, whether that was for a password or for something else. So I can't comment too much on that. But one thing I've noticed, at least with passwords and invalid characters or unknown characters, so for example, is it a zero or is it a capital O?
Yeah.
That can always be tricky, and I tend to copy and paste into different applications to actually make it more readable, because when you're typing a password or you're typing a username into a field, it can be a little tricky. So it's always good to know where you might get confused, but that can also be the security through obscurity as well. There are a lot of services out there, and a lot of them are used by many, many people on a daily basis. And I think overall, as long as you know that the institution you're utilizing has a pretty good reputation, I normally go that way.
Dan in West Allis, your turn now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was having problems with my internet service, and it they complained about the router I had, which was a Linksys router. And I went through I don't know how many routers, and now I have a Netgear router. Anyways, my virus software, which I'm drawing a blank on my virus software right now, when I had my Linksys router, and it searched my network to see if there were defects in my network and things like that, indicated no problems. Now that I have this Netgear router, My software says I have open ports facing the internet, which puts my network at risk. And I haven't had a chance to call NETGEAR to ask them about this and see what they say. And since you're having a security system, I was wondering if you know anything about this and would like to explain it to me.
And one thing I'm curious about is, do you have, or what is the software that you're using that's telling you about these open ports?
And I'm just drawing a blank right now what my virus software is. It's not one of the big ones, like, you know,
Norton or something like
things. It's not Norton. It's probably like a third, fourth tier, whatever, you know. And I'm just
a free one.
Just drawing a blank. It had a free edition, but I've subscribed to it just to get the extra features and stuff like that. And it does have a password manager built in, and you know, they keep updating features. I wonder if I have it. If I have it on my phone here, can you hang on for just a second? I'll look at my phone's screen.
Yeah, and
And I think the one item I was thinking about for the different application kind of running on your computer is before you can even get out to the internet, you have your computer on your local network. It connects from your local network to the outside world using your router. So your router is really the bridge that makes that internet connection possible. And the only way to really see, at least from your internet connection, whether you have open ports is actually really from the outside of your network. So your computer, if it remains in your home network, is behind your router. But to find out how to get into your network through your router, you have to be on the outside. And I was kind of curious from the software you had on your computer if maybe they have a service where they're actually trying to remotely connect to your network, your home network through your router, and that's where they're getting their data from, which would make sense. I just wasn't sure if that was the case or not, because it also could just be a false positive where it's saying, hey, you have ports open on your computer. It could actually be a coincidence where you replaced your router and... It actually has nothing to do with a router whatsoever. It could just be in your computer. Because all computers by default have open ports, but they have a local firewall on their computer that blocks incoming connections, whether it's the Windows firewall or the firewall built into Mac OS or other systems.
But I guess I'm still thinking that a call to Netflix or NETGEAR to find out. I guess what's a little confusing to me is the fact that with Linksys, my virus software didn't indicate this at all, but then what you're saying basically is a new router might be enough to have it recognize something it didn't recognize before.
It's possible. Any change can always bring up new things. It's also possible that after replacing, one piece of hardware with another, the problem that you're experiencing right now always existed.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. We don't know if it was the change that actually made these open ports possible or the open ports were always there but could only note it until there was a hardware change. And it really is, and I think if and when you do call Linksys or NETGEAR, I would definitely have the information for the software package you have on your computer because I think it'll help them understand and just troubleshoot with you what that message means and exactly how your router is kind of playing a part in that, because I think that's definitely a piece that is going to help bring everything together.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrew, our guest from the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your computer today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrew of the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology. Questions, we've dealt a little bit, zeroed in a bit on security, but we're taking other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Phil in Kingston up next. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my concern was a couple of months ago there was some type of white paper warning about WPA2, the current version, and that certain vulnerability that they discovered within the WPA2 for wireless home networks. And the second thing, on many, many models on HP laptops, they found that under the diagnostics and manufacturing these HP laptops, a keylogger was left intact. It was deactivated, but the keylogger was left, which was used for, I guess, WPP diagnostics on that. And I guess the urging was for that keylogger to be removed and so forth. But more importantly, the WPA2 vulnerability that was discovered about 2 or 3 months ago. If you could answer that, it'd be great.
And I can't say too much about the WPA2 vulnerability. There are different updates available for a variety of manufacturers.
Are probably wondering what the heck is WPA2.
Yeah, that's a good, great question. So WPA or WPA2 is actually used for wireless protection, or in this case, wireless authentication. Something we saw before was WEP, W-E-P. Now we have WPA and WPA2. They add numbers as, you know, new revisions come out, and they become, in theory, a little bit more secure over time. In this case, with anyone utilizing WPA2, which is generally something broadcast from an access point that you connect from a laptop, from a cell phone, or other devices, there was a vulnerability that basically could allow somebody to get information from the network traffic that you're sending back and forth. They could snoop in on your network conversation or potentially break into an access point. And that was a big concern because, you know, people don't want people breaking into their networks or seeing the data that they have. And WPA2 had this vulnerability, and there's patches that are basically being released and have been released for a variety of manufacturers. I don't have a big list with me. One thing I did see was that iOS and, or in this case, macOS and Windows users, for most cases, actually, the vulnerability didn't apply to those operating systems outside of a very small amount of end users, but was primarily more so for other devices, whether they're access points or routers. And as long as you keep those devices up to date, that's really the recommendation. Make sure to apply the security updates and patches that you get from your router, access point, operating system. Any of those manufacturers always keep your stuff up to date, and that should help. At least with the WPA2, I can't answer if, you know, any specific vendors still has an issue with it or not. But keep things up to date is going to help. There might be another wireless standard here at some point. I'm not sure when. I haven't researched it. But just keeping things up to date should take a little bit of that strain off. And it's been about a couple months since that. So keep things updated. Hopefully it's not going to be too much of an issue. And then the other question was...
Yeah, the keylogger left on HP laptops.
Yes, the keylogger. And that was actually something I hadn't heard of before. For the keylogger, and you're still using an HP laptop, is that correct?
Yes, actually I saw it on a white paper like 2 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. And then by 9 o'clock the following morning, the BBC had it.
Yep. Yeah, and the... The only thing that you could really, and it sounds like it was something that they had seen. It was part of the touchpad software, actually, interestingly enough, which the touchpad, depending on your laptop, it either is kind of embedded with the keyboard or it's not. But that's where that kind of keylogger portion kind of comes in. And if you actually uninstall and reinstall the software, that should be enough that does it. Although I didn't find a lot of other information regarding specifically that keylogger. I don't think that, at least in this case, I'm guessing it's not even probably seen by antivirus programs, but I don't know.
Okay. All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Phil. Sully in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Sully.
Hi. A couple months ago, there was a credit union up here in Green Bay known as Fox Communities Credit Union. One of the ATMs was actually hacked, and a bunch of user information was actually stolen from that, assuming people had used the ATM. My question is then, after that, how would the credit union update their security software?
And in this case, it does depend on how the ATMs were breached. Do you know if it was they were scanning people using cards, or were they able to access other data through the ATMs?
I have no idea. I'm just a user of the credit union, and I had heard this only a couple months ago.
Okay. And I'm trying to look up a little bit to see if I can find out more info. But at least the one thing I've heard more often is on ATMs, what they tend to do is install what they call a credit card skimmer. So it's something that they can put on top of the, basically the normal reader that reads credit cards. So when you put in your card and take it back, it reads that Stripe information, which gives basically your credit card number, the expiration date, and it also gives the security ID. You can actually buy credit, just simple credit card readers. They're actually like $5 or $10. You can put it into your computer, open Notepad, and just scan your cards. You'll see all the data that's there. And that's generally what most people are doing. They're skimming the credit card information, then they're taking that device off, and it just happens to have all these wonderful credit card numbers that they can use at some other point in the future. That's most commonly what you see with those ATM scams. And it's not the fact that they necessarily got their environment hacked or other sensitive data was released, but they were able to get credit card numbers that they could use for transactions. Potentially, they could use it for customer verification, but it depends on the company. Most companies don't use a credit card number for verification purposes. So it's generally used to really steal money, to buy things, to utilize the credit cards in ways that, well, you don't want because you don't want to be buying all this stuff. And a lot of different companies will actually install hardware that don't allow you to install a skimmer in the same way. Some different companies, they'll actually do daily checks to verify whether there's a skimmer on or off all the ATMs. They'll install different pieces of hardware to make sure that skimmers can't be installed. They'll also install cameras to verify whether anyone's tampering with anything. So there's a lot of physical security controls that different companies utilize to make sure skimmers can't be installed. And generally, that's at least what I've seen in the past. Every now and again, there's more reports, probably every week or even every day, of people installing these skimmers, and they'll just drive around, they'll install a skimmer, they'll come back in a few days, they'll collect it, and they'll have their bunch of credit card numbers, and they're going to do their thing. But usually it's not the credit card was actually hacked, it's they managed to put something in, so while the bank was able to process your transaction, they were able to steal your credit card number. And that's usually what I've seen more often.
With the ATMs, well, I had some folks on from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and one thing they say that you can do when you go to an ATM is these skimmers are typically they're designed to be taken off relatively easily, and the one thing you should do every time is grab a hold, and they say, you know, the ones that are okay, you can pull hard on those and they're not going to go anywhere or do anything, but you could literally pull a skimmer off just by, and I actually do that when I, you know, the gas station, I'll take a hold of it and pull hard on it, and if it doesn't come off, I'm pretty sure that it's not going to be an issue. So it's something physically we can all do.
Yeah, and that's something I saw with a local credit union around town. And the next thing I saw a week later was this metal bar in place so someone couldn't install a skimmer. It was one of the remediations they had put in place to try to reduce the likelihood of somebody installing at least the same skimmer.
Yeah,
that could be done. There's a variety of stuff going out there, but most likely that's what happened. And yeah, it's a good thing to just pull on a little bit because they are meant to come off. Because if you're stealing credit cards, your idea is pop it on, come back, pull it off, and drive away.
Do
it should be easy.
Quickly.
Exactly.
Sully, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Jeff emailed to ask if any suggestions for good the password managers, and I guess you've already talked about, you like LastPass is one that you like, and Dashlane, someone else mentioned another one that they like using.
Yeah, and Dashlane's not one I use, but it has really, really great reviews.
Yeah.
So it's definitely another one to take a look into. And some of these, you know, they go from it costs you $0 at all to maybe it'll cost you, and I don't know if these are annual or monthly, but it'll cost you more money than free. And it really depends on how much you utilize, how many passwords do you have, excuse me, but also the various devices that you use. Is it cross-compatible? Dashlane was one that did have a lot of great reviews and a lot of people really liked. I haven't used it personally, but it does have a lot of features. And you'll see that different companies will go back and forth. One that I've seen utilized a lot was RoboForm, specifically for browsers to just get information input regularly in a more secure manner. But there's tons out there.
Parker emailed to say when he's in a hotel, he uses a Wi-Fi extender with a password. Will doing this actually make him more secure?
And if it's using a Wi-Fi extender,
a password.
It might. But overall, I think it's still probably connecting to the same wireless. To be honest, I'm not sure. I'd have to think about exactly how the Wi-Fi extender was being used. If you're extending, like, let's say, the hotel's network for you to just connect again, I don't know if it's really going to obscure anything to the point where the hotel couldn't get anything. You're still going through the hotel's network connection. And it's really difficult to know what's in between your computer and the internet. And the hotel, in this case, would still have some access. So there's kind of two different threats going on. One is, are you concerned with the hotel seeing your information? And the other one is, are you concerned with any other individuals at the hotel getting your information or getting access to your computer? Because having the extender doesn't necessarily help you safeguard your data from the hotel, but it will help a little bit with other computers in the hotel.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, we'll take a quick look at the news and then we'll be back to talk with him about more computer issues. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about computers with Jesse LeGrew. He is a technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Have you been having problems with your computer or maybe your smartphone or your tablet? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And Kate in Pewaukee has a question for you, Jesse, so let's go there.
Well, thank you for taking my call. For the last, maybe 2 weeks, 10 days, 2 weeks, when I try to go to Google, I get a notice that says trustee rapport and rapport extension, and then it says IBM trustee rapport was installed successfully, but extension is disabled, and I should use the extension manager to enable the rapport extension. Then it gives a little box where I can click OK, and it'll go away. Or it also has a thing that says need help, ? And when I clicked on that, it went to a lot of stuff that I didn't understand. Do you know, is this trustee rapport thing an OK thing? Or
In this case, the software, it could be. There is a software, security software that actually does have the exact same name that you listed from, you know, that pop-up. So it could be valid software that was either installed when your computer, you know, was originally set up before you purchased it, or it could be software that was installed afterwards. What kind of computer do you have?
Oh, golly.
What kind of computer?
I'm sorry. I'm not there. Just a sec.
And it's no problem either. So the software is actually different.
It's an Acer brand.
Okay.
And we've had it for several years, and I've had Google for several years, and this was just something new that has been showing up, and I just was
worried about it a little bit, maybe. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I think in this case, most likely what it is, with a lot of different web browsers that are coming out, there's a lot of security updates, a lot of things that As time moves on, they're basically purposefully breaking because of the fact that they don't necessarily work in the most secure manner. It could be that this IBM software may be one of those pieces of software, especially if it is a little bit more out of date. Whether you do want to update it or not, I would probably actually look at Acer's website to see if they did have any other information or updates for the software. I wasn't able to find anything just quickly myself, but I would actually go to the Acer website. They usually are very good about having downloads for security and software updates, and they might have one specifically for this IBM Trust software. And it is something that a lot of other companies out there utilize, but it's a place I would go to see if it did come with your computer. If it didn't, you could also easily uninstall it. That would also remove the pop-up from your web browser. But it's possible it could be a valid piece of software. It just may be out of date. So I'd look for Acer to try to update it. Or in most cases where I see this kind of being used, it's actually used by some financial institutions, and there's a few other things. It could be valid, but my guess is you may not need it on your computer if you have your own antivirus or anti-spyware, such as Symantec, Norton, or other security software.
So go to Acer and take a look and talk with them a bit. Thank you so much, Kate, and good luck with that. Appreciate it. Jim in St. Croix Falls, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi. I have a problem with the I have a web page up, and it says that a Windows firewall has detected security breach from this IP address. This IP has been used for illegal activity. It wants me to call an 833 number to get them to fix it for me. And it seems fishy to me. I don't know. What do you think?
And it definitely sounds very fishy to me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't probably trust the message. It's not something that you might get, you know, a firewall detected message, but the fact that it's having you call a specific number, I'm guessing if you had the phone number, we could probably even Google the phone number, and we're going to find out that is probably from a scammer. But what you're probably seeing is actually an infection itself.
Should I just Google that? It's an 833. Just put that in. Just Google that number and see what it says.
Yeah, and I would definitely use a different computer or a different cell phone just to Google the information. But the information that even you just supplied to me, I mean, I'm 99% sure from what I've seen in the past that this is probably really a fake message that you're seeing, and they want you to call so they can probably promise you they're going to fix it, and they're going to charge you money, and
they're going to want to get into your computer.
Yep.
So do I just X out of it, the page?
If you can, it may not let you. I'd probably recommend there are a couple things that you can do to potentially resolve the problem. Do you have an antivirus program on your computer?
Yeah, I do.
I would recommend running that. I would also recommend potentially, if you're able to, downloading a program such as SpyBot Search and Destroy or Super Anti-Spyware. Both of those are both free programs that can help to remove malicious software. And even if the software is still running, ideally, we'd want it all shut down so it can clean it out appropriately. It'll probably give you a pretty good indication whether the software you're seeing is actually malicious or not. It'll be able to find it during a full scan of your computer. It may be able to remove pieces, and you may have to scan it several times. But it's a possibility you may not be able to completely close the program, at least through just clicking on the X and closing the box. It may be very, very persistent and may continually pop up messages. So I'd try to at least run a full antivirus scan on your computer, but also download a program like SpyBot Search and Destroy or Super Anti-Spyware. And if you really need, I would even recommend going to a company that is trained to remove these kind of infections, because my guess is it is an infection. And some of the free programs that are out there can help you to remove it. And I think those will work very well. But you might also want to get a second look at it.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this SpyBot search and destroy one word?
It is SpyBot's one word, and then you'll see search and destroy. If you Google that, you'll find it. I don't think it's like spybot.com, but it is available on a lot of different websites. It's actually safer-networking.org, and they have an application that you can download, and there's a lot of other free applications like that. But SpyBot Super Anti-Spyware are two good programs.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Sue in Sussex emailed to say that she has heard that Google's Wi-Fi 3 pack, which is supposed to replace a person's router and create a network throughout a home, exists. She's been looking for a replacement for the router she rents from her provider. Is this a wise thing to do?
In this case, it depends on... So the three-pack that Google has for the Wi-Fi systems, it really is to extend wireless with, you know, a larger building so you get more coverage. That's why it has three of those access points. And it could replace a router. And a lot of people really like it. I haven't used it myself, but a lot of people think that it works really, really well. It's easy to set up. You can help set it up with a smartphone, and you can be off and running pretty quickly. Now, whether it'll replace your rented router, which could also be a modem, that I'm not sure about.
Yeah.
Because it's very likely you still need that hardware. It's possible you need to plug in your Google Wi-Fi system into that. So you may not be able to get rid of that piece of hardware, but you could have other options to replace it. You can actually... Generally, a lot of companies will rent it out either for free, is actually becoming much more common now. But if you do have to pay a monthly service fee, I would recommend calling them to see if there is an option, one, to simply buy a piece of hardware, because they're actually only about $50.
Yeah.
You can even go to Best Buy and just buy what they call a cable modem, and it may also have a router. So you may not be able to replace it with Google Wi-Fi. You could replace it with other items. But Wi-Fi, the Google Wi-Fi, a lot of people really love the hardware. It works really well, easy to set up, and gives them everything they need wirelessly. It just might not replace your hardware without knowing a little bit more, but I would contact your internet service provider just to verify, because it's possible you would actually need to, that hardware wouldn't fit all your needs.
Judith in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Judith.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hopefully this is simple, and it's probably a not very bright question, but we'll try it anyway. I have a printer error I can't seem to eradicate. The printer is an HP. Using the help internal to my computer system, it asked me if it was on the on-home network. There's only one computer the printer is hooked to, the PC. And I am wondering, is it possible I need to update a driver?
It's most of the time I would say probably not, unless you know something else had changed. That being said, many times just updating the drivers on your computer can help to fix a lot of problems and even add more functionality to the device that you already have. So I would recommend, at least as a first troubleshooting step, if you're having issues with the printer, download the latest software. You can get them directly from HP's website, and it's likely it might fix the issue. It sounds like you're probably using wireless printing from your computer to your printer.
Correct.
Okay. Do you know when the last time you installed your HP software on your computer was?
Probably 3 to 4 months ago. We had recently purchased a new computer.
Okay.
So we redid it. It's odd, although it happened when I was attempting to print something from our municipal site, which has often proved a problematic site to use, I must say.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Another thing I'd recommend, you can update the driver software. It's unlikely. It kind of depends. They don't give a lot of different driver updates.
Okay.
So 3 or 4 months, there may have not been an update.
Mm-hmm.
You might just want to restart your computer. But before that, I'd restart the printer. So turn the printer off, turn the printer back on. It may resolve the issue there.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
And I've turned the computer off and on several times.
Okay.
Sorry, that's the first thing I tried. You know, it's the old Xerox copy machine thing. Open, turn it off, open all the doors, close them, turn it on, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, first thing you try, it has done nothing.
Do you?
And I am, as a result, unable to, of course, access the printer, which I need.
Is your computer the only computer utilizing the printer?
Yes.
Okay. What I would probably do at that point, I would try reinstalling the driver software. I would actually go to your computer and go to the control panel.
Right.
I would actually just remove all the HP software, HP printer software, and then download the latest drivers and software from HP.
Okay.
And reinstall it. Because normally through that process, it will try to detect that wireless network for that printer and try to set it up from scratch. And hopefully it's going to find your printer and be able to set it up and everything's going to work again. If it can't find it, it's indicative of probably some kind of networking issue, whether it could be with the printer, and most likely it's with the printer connecting to your home network.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good first step, is to reinstall that driver software and see if it's able to detect your printer.
There you go.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Judith. Tom in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Jesse, I've got a question. When you mentioned SpyBot, it made me think of what I've been told by my antivirus and the Internet Protector, AVG. I use AVG. And I used to have SpyBot, Malwarebytes, CCleaner, and they say, don't use those because they work against one another. And I've heard that before, and you should only have one antivirus or internet security software loaded. Could you clarify or provide more information on that?
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good point with those specific examples too. For antivirus, you really do only want to have one, just because they will conflict. If you have two antivirus programs that are trying to clean an infection, for example, you might see them play a tug of war and neither one quite winning and you not actually being able to clean the infection. But it also is the difference between having an active scanning solution and a more passive or manual scanning solution. So most antivirus programs are running on your computer constantly. They're looking for things that are changing, things in memory, and trying to resolve those as they pop up. Other programs have active components, but generally are only act as you scan applications, such as SpyBot Search and Destroy or Super Anti-Spyware. I use multiple programs if I need to clean a computer, just because there's no one application that finds everything. So when I try to clean a computer, I generally will use a variety of tools. But for mine, I only use active scanning from my primary antivirus application, but I might use the other applications for a manual supplemental scan, but I'll disable their active scanning features.
Ah.
That helps.
All right. There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry on Facebook would like to know if you have any knowledge of an app called Skimmer Scanner. And what it does, it claims to be able to detect Bluetooth skimmers on ATMs or gas pumps by having one's phone with Bluetooth on held next to the pump or ATM. It has good reviews, but how accurate is it?
And I actually I'm just taking a look at it now, and I've not had any experience personally with the software application. I think it's possible it could work fine. I think the only risk that comes along with using this kind of application is it could give a false sense of security, where if it tells you that there's no skimmer, there may actually be. There's a lot of different technologies out there, so you just never know. It may be useful in detecting one type of very specific skimmer, but it's possible it misses the mark on other types of skimmers. So it may work fine, but I would just be conscious that it may not find everything. And if you really are trying to be concerned with the skimmer, you want it to find everything. So it may work well, but note that it probably has limitations just due to the technologies you have on your phone, because it does rely on the technology you have on your phone to find things. If there's a new technology that your phone can't utilize, it's a blind spot. Yeah. And it may not be able to find everything. So it may work well, but just note it may not work perfectly in every situation.
So grab a hold of and tug on that to make sure that that's still a physical way that you can help determine.
Yeah, and with a variety of payment methods now that you can use wireless and scanning, there's just a lot of risks there, which come with, you know, new ways to get around or to circumvent security controls. So there's lots of scary things out there.
Mike in Lake Mills emailed to say he has Witopia, which he believes created encrypted tunnels through which he connects to the net. Do you have any thoughts on these kinds of programs, and would they protect when used in a hotel situation?
And in those cases, I think most of the times what Witopia is a VPN service, or what they call a virtual private network. So it creates a secure tunnel, so everything's encrypted between you and this VPN service, and you can browse the web, you can do a lot of other things, and it won't necessarily be able to see that information through that tunnel. It does depend on the hotel wireless network, because there are still certain things that they may or may not be able to do with accessing other secured content. I'd say when traveling, it's a really great practice to have of using a VPN service to secure your network traffic. I think that's something I would recommend anyone do whenever they're traveling anywhere, unless you know that your network is completely secure. If I wanted to be super paranoid, I'd probably use a VPN service at home too, just to make sure, at least have that extra step of security, knowing that people can't get to my network traffic. So I think it's a definitely a good thing to do when traveling, and I think it's very, very helpful, but there might even be ways around that.
Rebecca on Facebook says she bought her grandson a brand new Dell laptop for Christmas. Now it's saying it needs to update and something about BIOS. It's making it seem like a really major thing. Why would you have to have a critical update so quickly after purchase?
Well, one possibility, which, you know, I'm kind of reaching here a little bit, but since we did have this Intel vulnerability that was announced, I shouldn't say Intel, but specifically x86 architecture chips and processors, having this vulnerability starting in January that was announced, it's very likely that it was just coincidence. You bought it. There's security updates that happen all the time. In this case, it's really just the timing. There are updates that happen every month for every platform. A lot of them are security related. Timing's a big portion of it, but keeping the systems up to date is going to be important.
Really important.
And sometimes you never know when you buy a computer. It could have been in a box for 3 months. If it's in a box for 3 months, there's 3 months of updates it didn't have. It's difficult to have everything fully updated when somebody buys something off the shelf, because you need to package it and ship it off somewhere. So there's only a certain amount of time that they can keep those up to date. But it could also be related to the chip stuff that's coming out right now. So it happens. Just continue to keep it updated. The more you keep it updated now, the less frequent you should see those.
Jesse, thank you so much. You're back on March 5th. We'll do this all over again. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead with the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology. Thanks to him, and thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store.